This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff. Larry Yates, who lives in Winchester, has been a social justice organizer for over four decades.
And here's to you, my rambling boy. May all your rambling bring you joy.
What I do for a job, and it's again, that's not all I am. I work for a group called Witness to Innocence. It's an organization of some of the 140 people in this country who were on death row and were one way or another were found to be innocent and are now out of prison.
And how are you working with them?
Well, what I do mostly is I'm the intermediary between them and state coalitions. There are coalitions in every state that has a death penalty, opposing the death penalty. These exonerees, exonerated death row survivors, they are incredible speakers against the death penalty. Nate Fields was at JMU, and he had a large auditorium full of college students enthralled. A lot of professors probably would have killed to be able to do what he did, you know. Individual stories are immensely powerful. It's also immensely powerful to understand there's a system behind the stories. And that's one of the, I mean, when Nate spoke at JMU, he was also talking about the death penalty system. He was talking about other people he knew on death row. But he made the system come alive because it was personal. So I'm very explicitly not somebody who thinks in terms of just dealing with individual problems. I'm very much somebody who is about changing the system, but greatest force to change the system is the testimony and the actions, real people who have actually experienced what's going on.
How did you come to believe what you just said?
It fundamentally really goes back to my raising, as we say, you know, my family. I come from a unusual family background in a sense in that I grew up until I was 14. I was overseas about half the time, mostly in Southeast Asia. And my father is a linguist, a social scientist, and he thinks in as a social scientist, that is, he thinks about, and not all social scientists do this, but he thinks about real people and what's actually happening to them. We were in Thailand for 5 years, and he modeled working with his Thai colleagues in a respectful way. I don't know that he used that word.
Modeled for you?
Modeled for me, yes. And I certainly knew other American kids, though I went to a school that wasn't just Americans. But I knew there are a lot of Americans in Thailand who pretty much looked down on the Thais or had no relationships at all. They just happened to be in somebody else's country, but they might as well have been back in the States, you know, doing their jobs, or they made fun of Thais, you know. But my dad had an attitude of respect. These were his colleagues. These were people he worked with. That he cared about, he brought home for dinner.
It was interested in.
Yeah. These were the people he worked with. He worked at a teacher training school developing English teaching programs, and all his colleagues were Thai, almost all of his colleagues. And so that's, you know, and he was fascinated by the work, and a lot of them are very smart people, and he liked working with them. So I got that modeled for me. We came back to the States in 1964. A couple of big things were going on at the time. One was the freedom movement. The other was the Vietnam War was starting to ramp up. Both of those were very personal to me and also in some ways very easy to understand.
Explain those two statements, please.
Sure. Well, the Vietnam War in particular is very personal because I'd been in Vietnam. You know, I lived there for 2 years, a small child, but I lived there. Was in Thailand longer, and while Thailand is, of course, different from Vietnam, it's more similar to Vietnam than the United States is. So, and in Thailand in particular, I had very close relationships with people who were Thai, Chinese, you know, other cultures, other so-called races. You know, when you shoot or blow up or imprison a Vietnamese person, it means something to me that it might not mean to most Americans. When you blow up the countryside, it means something to me, you know. With the freedom movement, the African-American freedom movement, I wasn't as immediately connected, partly because I had literally never known any African-Americans living overseas, and very few. But my dad helped me make the connection. He took me to meetings happening on fair housing. I mean, he didn't have to drag me, but I was interested, but he took me. And we talked about his bringing up in the South. He grew up under Jim Crow. He's white. I'm white. So I came into it with an interested attitude, and again, that basic idea of respect that
for what individuals the, rather
right yeah. for well, it's always about nothing happens generically, which doesn't mean you can afford not to think about it systemically and generically. You know, everything you do with real people. But at the same time, if you only think about the individuals, you're missing an enormous part of the picture. So it's a balance, you know. I had that respect for those people. I listened to what was being said. And with Vietnam, it was more than just respect for people. It was an enormous emotion because part of it, again, was just the landscape. You know, it's the landscape I
And you had an emotional attachment to it.
Oh, very strong. That's where I started writing poetry. As tractor trailers rumble past on the interstate, enclosed in my Civic's space, I sing along with an exile's recorded lament, fearing that the pretty folk song could come to be my own, that losing hope I might accept exile from a homeland aching of shame and corruption. My eye catches a heron far above the highway. Night is falling. It must be winging home. Behind it, the new moon. It's so much easier to believe in the gross power that roars in the next lane, threatening and seductive, than to remember and to know that what looks so fragile in the darkening sky can and does summon up tides that no ruler and his cronies have ever turned back. The best formal education I got was in Bangkok. I went to a very good, very cosmopolitan private school. One of the most wonderful things about it, I mean, I think I'm coming back to the same themes, was that it was multicultural before multicultural was a word. So when I got back to the States, the high school I went to, which was in Fairfax County, a very good reputation, didn't do anything for me at all academically. I just kind of breezed through that. I went to the University of Michigan. But by this point, academia was just not relevant. I needed to be out there. I needed to be doing something. There was an emergency in the world, and I was much more attached to that than I was to, you know, so-called learning things in school.
The military declined to draft Larry Yates, in part because he wrote his draft board stating his intention to organize if he was drafted. So this left Larry Yates free to jump unreservedly into what turned into lifelong social activism. Were you just opposing or were you building something?
Building is a funny word. I mean, I have a knee-jerk reaction. People say, oh, you're just knocking things down, you're not building things. Well, there are a lot of things that need to be knocked down. If that's all I accomplished in my life, I wouldn't feel bad about it. I mean, you could say all Martin Luther King did was knock down Jim Crow. So what good was he? He never built anything. But I think I was beginning to understand that we were building a movement and that it was going to take a long time.
And the movement was?
An oppositional movement. And I also understood it, we didn't start it. You know, there were some people who, in fact, there was a magazine or paper called The Movement. You know, and it talked about John Brown, it talked about Frederick Douglass, you know, talked about the first wave of feminists. And of course, internationally, we felt very connected, you know, not just to the Vietnamese, but to the massive anti-war
movement. You mean the
movement
felt,
yeah,
this
yeah, right,
nascent
right.
movement.
So there definitely was a feeling of being part of something and a feeling that I personally was choosing to be part of something. I mean, I did even, you know, when I was 19, I did have some self-consciousness and I did think about, you know, what am I giving up? How am I putting myself at risk? But, you know, is it worth it?
And why was it worth it? Obviously it was.
Well, not to get too theoretical, I think at first what you do becoming an activist is you react with a feeling, I have to do this. That's the beginning stage. You know, it's just, this is happening and I have to do something about it. that only happens if somebody comes up to you and offers you an opportunity to do something about it. I mean, there are people who just go off by themselves and do things. I don't consider them activists. In fact, in a lot of cases, they're counterproductive. But if somebody offers you an opportunity, gives you some facts, and you say, I've got to respond, I have no choice. And that's where it starts, I think. Down the road, there are some real benefits. You know, I mean, I've been doing this for 45 years. You know, down the road, the key benefit is people. You connect to the best people, in my opinion. I'm prejudiced, but you meet wonderful people who are serious about life, though they're also enjoying it, who really want to do something, and you meet them at their best.
Wait a minute. You could say all of that about somebody who is a complete materialist?
I don't think so.
Okay, but so we need to define what you mean by serious about life.
I mean, they're actually thinking about how life happens and what they want to do about it. You know, they're not accepting what they're getting over the TV set.
And thinking about it in terms of how people are relating to other people?
People are relating to other people, how systems work to keep us separated and to harm people. You know, they're thinking about the whole picture, you know. Mm-hmm. They're not accepting the propaganda, you know, that, again, comes out of the TV primarily, though NPR is not completely blameless.
Over the course of your experience, has your belief in activism increased, or has your cynicism increased?
Well, I've really never been a cynic. I'm not a cynic by nature. And, you know, when I was younger, I occasionally would be a dupe. I mean, I'm more on that end of the spectrum. I worked at a jail for a while, and in any jail, there are some people who are very, very good at manipulating you. And I got manipulated a couple of times. But I'd rather err on the side of trusting people. You know, but you have to be careful in this life. So I'm not really a cynic. I would say that as my understanding of the craft of organizing grows, I'm probably more optimistic because I see how it's done, and I see that it has been done. You see it happening in every kind of situation. The freedom movement has had repercussions and people copying it and doing the same things in Poland, you know, in Nepal, wherever, you know. And in turn, it was, you know, learning from Gandhi, who learned from Tolstoy, who learned from I don't even know who, but I know there was somebody back there. So I'm not cynical, and I think I'm hopeful, not out of, you know, some sort of pie in the sky kind of thing. And I certainly don't. The idea that, well, we have to win or we have to do this, I don't buy that. I mean, we lose. You know, the movement loses. It happens. You know, I'm not a big fan of the, I probably shouldn't admit this, but the people united will never be defeated is a big chant right now. It came out of Latin America. It sounds great, but it's not just not true. We do lose. Everybody loses, but there is a way to win. And, or there are many ways to win, but they're all related. They're all involved working with other people, respectfully, thinking strategically, and being courageous. You got to take a chance. If you do those things, you've got a chance. If you sit around and you say, boy, the world is terrible, well, you know, yeah, it's not going to stop, not going to change, you know, based on your behavior.
There are nicer ways to do it, but the nice way always fails.
Back after a break with Sarah Cohen's excellent potato chip adventure.